This weekend, Winston-Salem Symphony music director Robert Moody concludes his 10th anniversary season with a concert featuring Gustav Mahler's powerful First Symphony. Maestro Moody says he's proud of what the orchestra's musicians, staff, board members, and volunteers have accomplished during his tenure. They've extended the orchestra's reach with Pops concerts, Kicked Back Classics and Handel's Messiah series, and Discovery Series concerts for kids. They've also brought the youth orchestra into the fold, expanding the number of youth orchestras and offering free community concerts. All of this accomplished while keeping the orchestra in the black. Bob says there's more to do, but he's feeling pretty good about things right about now, including the inclusion of the first work on the final program of the season, Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 1, The Titan.
I go back to my teens with this piece, and I guess to start the story, I should begin by reminding folks that I don't come from a classical music family. You know, country music, church music, and football, marching bands. This was the music. That was sort of the tapestry of my youth.
What was the city again?
Greenville, South Carolina.
Greenville.
Although I have to say that I'm from Greenville. My family is from a place called Possum Kingdom, South Carolina.
And, Possum Kingdom.
Yeah,
I love that
that's
one.
That's exactly right. And I have a couple of memories in my teen years that really changed my life. One of them, when I was a young teen, I got to see the Clemson Tigers beat Nebraska at the Orange Bowl, finish an unbeaten season, and win the national championship. When that happened, when the final, you know, cannon shot and time was out, I cried. I was covered with goosebumps, and I was filled with this unbelievable exhilaration. I didn't think it could be topped. A couple of years later, I was 16, and I went to a high school for the arts. Very lucky in Greenville that we had a public high school for the arts. And my class went to see the Chicago Symphony on tour. They came to Greenville, South Carolina. They played in the auditorium at Furman University, and with their conductor, Sir George Schulte, they played the Mahler First Symphony. You know, Schulte, one of the greatest conductors of all time, Chicago Symphony, one of the finest orchestras on the planet. And when the finale of the work came, and if people don't know, but the composer asks for many of the brass to actually stand to play the finale. When this happened, I started crying. And an even greater sense of rhapsodic euphoria, and really also a very conscious thought, this is what I want to do with my life. And I want to be a conductor. I was looking at that guy, George Schulte, down on the stage, and I thought, I want to do that. And it's been with me ever since. Mm-hmm. And this is not my first time to conduct the Mahler 1. I've conducted it several times, but boy, it's such a like time travel experience for me. I'm right back to sitting in the balcony and hearing the CSO play that piece, you know, back in 1983, every time I'm dealing with it.
Not only was the Chicago Symphony known as this great orchestra back then under George Schulte, but it was basically, Mahler was right in their wheelhouse. It had the greatest brass section in the world.
The greatest horn player, the greatest trumpet player alive at the time were playing in that orchestra.
And right here you've got the great Anita Serbo at the top end, and you've got Matt Ransom on the bass. And
you've got
an amazing section. I'm thinking about Bud Hirsuth and Arnie Jacobs playing the tuba back then, but you've got a great foundation here. And well, let's talk a little bit about the piece, because, I mean, for those who've never been to a symphony concert before, never heard of Mahler, this would be just a great entree for you.
Well, Gustav Mahler is one of the most fascinating characters, I think, in all of music history. And one of the reasons so is that he was born and raised in a town in which he had this sort of cacophony of sounds happening around him. You know, he was born in a small town in an area that is now the Czech Republic and, you know, sort of part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he was a Jewish child living in a town with a lot of military. There was a strong military presence there. He, as a small child, sang in services in the boy choir at the local Catholic church. And this town was surrounded by forests and streams. And by the way, his father was a tavern owner. And so this kind of idea of like pub music from the late 19th century paired with Jewish melodies, paired with the great liturgical music he was hearing by being a ringer in a church, paired by the marching bands going by, and often his brain would begin to put all this music together. And you hear this in the Mahler First Symphony, beginning maybe where I think it should begin, with nature, with the sound of, you know, cuckoos and birds singing and the nightingale and this sort of thing happening. The sounds of nature begin the process, and then all of the other types of tonality and types of musicality begin to encroach upon this. It's brilliant. By the way, you know, Mahler was also one of the finest conductors of all time. In his lifetime, he was the Fonkerian. He was the James Levine of his time, conducting at all the great opera houses, the Vienna State Opera, eventually the orchestra that would become the New York Philharmonic. He was their music director. He only composed in the summers. He did this on summer vacation and gave us some of the most powerful music ever written.
I'm so glad you brought up all those different connections in his early beginnings, because the neat thing about his music for me is that he was one of the first composers who was unafraid to just juxtapose them back to back. You could go from that beautiful nature sound into a raucous beer hall and the scherzo back to back, and it all makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. The week before these performances, I will have the chance to spend a few days in Vienna. And if people have been to Vienna, they know that the graves of some of the most famous composers are all sort of right beside each other in the central cemetery. Beethoven, Schubert, and Brahms, for example, are all buried literally side by side. Mahler is not in this cemetery that sort of is the great tourist attraction. He's buried in a cemetery in the suburbs on the outskirts of Vienna, just a neighborhood cemetery. And I will, for the second time, make a pilgrimage to say hello to Maestro Mahler. By the way, his wife, Alma Mahler, is down about 10 tombstones down. She's not beside him. She's with Werfel, one of her later lovers. But I'm going to stand there and also think about the sounds of that city, the nature that you hear in the suburb in that part of Vienna, the honking car horns, the bells of St. Stephen's, because I think that understanding of music coming from all places is a real aid in understanding how to make music with Mahler.
So from the same region, in fact, would Anton Bruckner have been buried in that countryside place, or was he with the greats?
No, I think Bruckner is buried in Linz. Bruckner was born and raised in Linz, Austria, which is the town halfway between Salzburg and Vienna.
Okay.
And, you know, that orchestra in the opera house there is called the Bruckner Orchestra. And, of course, you know, this really has sort of gone by the wayside, but for, oh gosh, decades and decades, from the late 19th through the mid-20th century, there were really two camps among music aficionados and musicologists. There
That's
was the
right
Bruckner
there.
Camp and the Mahler camp. For, you know, it was almost like political parties. You had to sort of pledge your allegiance to one and disdain the other, or vice versa.
And before that, it was the Brahmsians and the Wagnerians.
Yeah, that's right. And the truth is, I did not program Bruckner for that reason. I programmed the Bruckner because I also wanted on this, my final concert of my 10th anniversary season, to have a strong choral component. I'm a choral conductor at heart. You know, that's where I began. My teacher, my mentor is Donald Newman. His teacher, mentor was Robert Shaw. So I really, you know, at the very base, I love choral music so very much. And the Bruckner Psalm 150 is just a brilliant choral music setting. If people know the psalm, this is the, you know, it's the last of the 150 psalms, and it's the one that talks about praising God with all manner of instruments, cymbals and trombones and what have you.
Bruckner is interesting for me in terms of his place in history because he's kind of coming out of that Romantic era, and yet we hear it now, and there's definitely a Romantic component. But back then, he had his detractors, as you mentioned, like the Hans Lick, the pro-Brahms folks who thought you were just too radical, and some pretty big fans as well, and it just happens to be one of them on the program. But Gustav Mahler, 36 years his junior, was a big Bruckner fan.
That's exactly right, and it's pretty interesting because between the two, any 19th century notions of Anton Bruckner, you know, about this music being somehow dissonant to the ear or too much of a departure from Brahms, from Wagner, if you listen to the work now, it sounds like it should, like some of the best writing of, you know, German Austrian Romanticism. And really, it's the Mahler that behaves much more, I think, like the bursting the doors of the 20th century wide open.
Winston-Salem Symphony music director Robert Moody. He'll celebrate his 10th season with the orchestra with season finale concerts this Saturday and Sunday nights at 7:30 at the Stevens Center and Sunday afternoon at 3. The Saturday performance is part of the Kicked Back Classic series, presented in a more informal atmosphere. After the show, concertgoers are invited to join Maestro Moody, guest artists, and members of the orchestra for Brews with Bob at Gray's across Cherry Street in the Marriott. You'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Twin City Stage concludes its 80th season with an audience favorite. Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike is currently the most produced play in the country, and Triad audiences have the opportunity to find out why when Twin City Stage's production opens on Friday, May 29th. The hilarious play, written by Christopher Durang, won the 2013 Tony for Best Play, among many other awards, and is loosely based on the works of Anton Chekhov. The original Broadway cast included David Hyde Pierce, Christine Nielsen, Sigourney Weaver, and UNCSA's own Billy Magnuson. Helping to bring this version to life are actors Mark Flora as Vanya and Janice Lovett as Sonia. They joined me in the studio to perform an opening scene from the play. Director Jim McKenney introduces it.
Sonia and Vanya have had a little bit of a strain in their usual morning routine, and Sonia has started breaking coffee cups. And we pick this up after the first cup has been broken. And follow through a little bit. You get a kind of a sense of their brother and sister relationship in this.
This coffee has gone quite cold now.
You're just determined to fight over the coffee, aren't you?
No, I'm really not. I'm debating whether to go microwave the coffee.
Do you want me to do it?
Would you? That would be very nice of you. What is the matter with you? You just threw the cup against the wall.
Do I have to do everything?
But you offered to take it. Are you bipolar now?
Yes.
Some people claim antidepressants help them.
If everyone took antidepressants, Chekhov would have had nothing to write about.
I'm not going to clean up the broken cups, you know.
Me neither.
Well, obviously, there's no solution.
The housekeeper comes today. We'll ask her to clean it up.
What if she refuses?
We'll fire her.
All right. We'll never ever pick the cups up, and instead we'll sell the house.
You can't sell it. You don't own it. Masha owns it.
I know Masha owns it, but if we leave broken cups and coffee smells all over the house, I'm sure she'll decide that she has to sell it, and you and I can finally live separately since we hate each other.
What a good idea!
A very good idea! It's comforting to have a pond to look at, isn't it? Pretty.
Yes. I hope the blue heron comes later.
I hope so, too. It's like a good omen.
Of course, it eats frogs. So it's not a good omen for them.
No. Nature is cruel, but pretty. And for some reason, I think of the blue heron as a harbinger of good luck.
So what I think is amazing is that in that scene, you see this arc. You see beginning with the familiarity between siblings and then a bit of angst. This familiarity has obviously bred some contempt, but then your characters return to this sort of comfort and a sense of peace. And all of this is captured in just a few minutes of dialogue. And I wonder what you think about, you know, this opening scene, whether it's an indication of what's to come.
Oh, absolutely. this is their daily routine, which is completely upset by the entrance of their sister, who they haven't seen in quite some time. And she brings along her 20-something boy toy, which really upsets Vanya because he's gay, but he has kind of lived this closeted life most of his life. And he's very attracted to Spike and also very upset by his sister's arguing. So it just kind of amps up from there.
Sonia is very upset by Masha coming and doesn't quite know what to do with the fact that Spike has come and he's all over the place and hugging people and, you know.
All over you and me.
All over everybody. and that's really fun to play because she's just sort of, it's like, oh, it's a man. You know, it's very interesting dynamic.
There are a lot of references to Chekhov and Chekhov's work throughout this play, and I'm wondering, is it necessary that someone be familiar with Chekhov in order to see this or to understand it fully? And are you all familiar with Chekhov?
Yes, I've seen many Chekhov plays. And what Christopher Durang did was he basically put all of this into a blender and mixed it up. And you don't really have to know the plays of Chekhov to enjoy the comedy, but if you do, you get the inside jokes.
In Chekhov's play, The Seagull, the family lives near a lake. In our play, the country house is by a pond. Masha, in our play, is also named for Chekhov's sister, Masha. And Masha shows up in other plays that he has written. Finding these little elements really is only important, I think, in the post dissection of the stories and the play and the direction in which you're going. I look at him now as the Russian equivalent of our Mark Twain. So he calls himself a physician and a dramatist, but I think he's a philosopher first and a little bit of a comedian as well. You know.
And how do you feel about that dynamic of comedy meeting philosophy? It seems like these two lend themselves to one another because you can sort of laugh about things on one hand, but actually you realize what you're laughing about is something so familiar that it's actually a very universal concept. So I've read that this play is a comedy, that it's sunny, but it also deals with darker themes.
It does. With regard to this story, we're dealing with losing a home. We're dealing with parents who passed away having had Alzheimer's. We're dealing with a completely dysfunctional family, repressed sexual desires, repressed everything. When you go back to what Sonia said about her wanting something to happen, but she wasn't sure what, that's a terrifically Chekhovian theme. He writes a lot about the fact that people have mired themselves in despair and depression. And he even says himself, you can even find happiness in Siberia, but you have to know you're unhappy first. And I think that's why his work lends itself toward depression and becomes so difficult to see because people, particularly Americans, I believe, we become embroiled in the fact that he preaches despair, but really he was a man of great faith and great belief that you had to pull yourself out of this mire and see the world for what it is so that you can reach beyond it.
I think the hardest thing is not to play the comedy, but to play it for the realism and the pathos, and the comedy comes from that.
Sometimes we have to turn on a dime. We'll be doing something serious, you know, having an intense argument, and then something funny will happen. it has to turn somehow, and it does, and it always does. And I think the ending especially is very hopeful and lovely, and but there's lots of just funny things that happen throughout the whole play. So, you know, even though there are all the things that Jim talked about, those things are underneath it all, and we do touch on all of them. But the turns of phrases that happen throughout the whole thing with all the characters are hysterical.
Right now, this is one of the most produced plays in the country. Does that affect your performances at all or your interpretations? And have you been looking towards the original cast at all for inspiration for your characters?
I got the lovely opportunity to see the original on Broadway and immediately fell in love with it and turned to my husband and said, I could play Sonia. I could do that. And I'm so pleased that I get to have this opportunity. I'm just over the moon about that. And I have obviously I saw that 2 years ago or something, 2.5 years ago, and have it in my head about, you know, the overall form of it and what Christine Nielsen did. But I have been trying not to look at anything else.
What was it about Sonia out of this cast? Why was it Sonia and not Masha that you felt you could identify with? And why was this the character that you wanted to play?
She's very lovable. She's very funny. She starts very schlumpy and gets to have this transformation, which I thought was really fun. Hopefully I can accomplish that. She was hysterical, and I just wanted to do that. I like comedy a lot, and I just wanted to be funny on stage, and this is giving me an opportunity, so it's great.
As an actor, I usually don't try to look at other people's performances, but find it within myself. But for this production, we are trying to do it because it's a new play. As closely as possible to the original Broadway version. So I watched the Broadway version and tried to channel David Hyde Pierce, which is extremely difficult. and then I realized that I just had to kind of make it my own because the comedy had to come from me because I'm not David Hyde Pierce.
Jim, how about you as a director?
I used the basis of the Broadway production and the production that was at the McCarter Theater as my jumping off point. And as with anything, especially a play that is new, you have the opportunity to put your own spin on it once you set the foundation. So our foundation was based on the Broadway production. And then I put my particular spin on it. I have a slightly demented sense of humor anyway. And so I was very fortunate in the cast that we've assembled to find actors who have an inventive sense of imagination. So I get them to a certain point, and then they sort of sprout their character wings and fly around the place. And when Janice says it's hysterical, it really is hysterical. And the characters work very well together. The actors are gelling and blending very nicely. I think the audience is going to have a ball.
Actors Janice Lovett and Mark Flora were joined by director Jim McKenney. Twin City Stage's production of Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike opens Friday, May 29th. Performances run this weekend and June 4th through the 7th. Thursday through Saturday shows are at 8 p.m. and Sunday matinees are at 2. For more information and an excerpt from a monologue by Vanya on the subject of technology in the modern age, visit our website at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Stay tuned, because coming up next, we take you to Iceland with the indie comedy Land Ho. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. In about 15 minutes from now, we'll feature a conversation with guitarist William Tyler. He's one of my favorite guitarists playing today. And after you give him a listen, who knows, he may wind up being one of yours. But first, let's hop on a plane to Iceland. The majestic landscapes of Iceland form the unexpected backdrop of the film Land Ho.
It's a story about two men in their 70s who go on an odd couple-style jaunt through the cities and countryside of Iceland. It's a buddy comedy and also a touching exploration of friendships and how they evolve through the years. The film was co-written and co-directed by Martha Stevens and Aaron Katz. They met at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, where they were studying film. Land Ho won the John Cassavetes Award for Best Feature under $500,000 at the 2015 Independent Spirit Awards. The film also turned up on many 2014 Best Of lists. It's also worth noting that the film's small successes are huge when you consider the fact that women are woefully underrepresented in the film business. Well, Martha Stevens, one half of the Land Ho directing-writing duo, is part of the vanguard of creative women who are changing this. And her journey began at UNCSA. In a big country dream, stay with you
like a lover's voice by the mountainside. Aaron and I met 12 years ago at the film school. And, both of us, I think, had a really good experience there. It was the type of school where someone like myself could flourish. You know, I don't know how well I would do at a place like NYU or UCLA, like a bigger school. It was more intimate, I guess, there. And at the time, I mean, Winston-Salem's much different now, but 12 years ago, there was nothing going on downtown in Winston-Salem. So there weren't as many distractions, I guess. So I think that, you know, that really made us, you know, bond, like, you know, the people that we still work with now that we went to school with, we really bonded over being isolated, I guess. So that was a good experience. And Aaron and I have, this is the first time either of us have co-wrote or co-directed anything with anybody else. We typically do our own projects, but for the sake of, you know, just making something fun, we thought it would be fun to try to collaborate for once.
And what is that like, co-writing and co-directing? I mean, are duties divvied up in a really specific way, or is it more of a natural, organic process when you begin working together?
I mean, when you think about co-directors, you know, they tend to be related in some way. You know, you think of the Coen brothers, people like that. So I think it's like you really just need sort of your own shorthand language with one another. You needed to know each other really well. And we didn't divvy up, you know, jobs on set. It was more organic than that, I guess. We shot the first 5 minutes of the movie in Kentucky a few months before we went to Iceland. And that was sort of a way to test the waters a little bit to see how we would work. And, you know, sometimes I would go over to the camera and then Aaron would go over and talk to the actors and vice versa. I mean, it was just, nothing was really planned. It was just flowing like that.
And what about as far as writing?
I guess I had the idea. I called Aaron up and I was like, I have a crazy idea for a movie, but we should make a movie in Iceland and we should take Erlin to Iceland, who Erlin plays Mitch. And from there, we started talking on the phone every day about, you know, developing the characters and the comedy. And once we did that, I wrote an outline and I handed off the outline to Aaron because I went to Iceland and Aaron didn't, and I location scouted specifically for the movie. So I wrote with all these locations in mind that I had seen while I was there. And then Aaron did, I think, the first draft, and then we passed it back and forth. Erlin's been in my other movie, so sometimes I went in and finessed his dialogue to be a little more Erlin-ish, I guess.
What inspired you to tell this story? It's a really unique adventure or buddy film. So what sparked the idea?
I think really just wanting to make a movie starring these two guys. I mean, we wrote the script with both Erlin and Paul in mind, and we just wanted to make a movie about these two guys. You know, people keep asking us why we're making a movie, we're 30 years old and we're making a movie about, you know, baby boomers, but we don't really see it that way. We just find them to be really fun to watch, and we wanted, to share Erlin's humor, and, you know, I think Paul's really relatable, and I think it worked out. So,
yeah, it definitely did. And I was going to ask you, you know, what the casting process was like, because the actors portraying Colin and Mitch are perfect. But it sounds like you had a prior relationship with these guys, or you've worked with them before. Is that the case?
Well, Erlynn is my cousin.
Okay.
He's my mom's first cousin. And so, yeah, he's been in all my films. And then Paul was in our Friends movie that played at Sundance the year prior. And so we had seen Paul in that movie. And we just thought he was really kind of special to watch. So we didn't really know Paul, but we knew, you know, I knew Erlynn. But, you know, we talked to Paul about the project before we started pursuing it to make sure he would be on board.
They give those type of performances that make someone say, like, oh, are they non-actors? Just because they're so natural and yet also seem to be just slightly aware that they're in a film. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but, like, there's this newness to the performance. I mean, are they new to acting, or have they both been acting, like, a long time?
Well, Erlynn's not an actor. He's actually a surgeon in real life,
His
character. And Paul is an actor. He's a professional actor. I think he, you know, had a pretty steady career going in Australia, and then he moved to the States when he, I think he married an American woman and moved to the States and is based out of Seattle and is, you know, doing small projects right now. He's hoping to break in and, you know, get some bigger roles, hopefully. But yeah, he's been doing it for a long time.
And with these characters, they're very distinct, very different. Mitch needs people. He's more outgoing. Colin's more restrained, maybe a little bit pent up. I know you were inspired by the gentlemen themselves, but was it difficult to write for such distinct personalities?
I think it's easier to write for distinct personalities and to write with, you know, your actors in mind and, you know, their little nuances and, you know, their... You can use some of their slang. I mean, I prefer it that way. I think it definitely makes it easier.
Okay. Let's talk about Mitch a little bit. He's kind of a randy, older gentleman. He has a really ribald sense of humor. Something I was thinking about while I was watching it is that it's an endearing character trait, and it's something that tweaked a little bit maybe wouldn't be so endearing. It seemed like that would have been difficult to get across, but once again, is it just because that's how he is and those are the kinds of jokes he makes, or...
Yeah, it's pretty similar to the way he is. I mean, it's all in good fun, you know. None of it is mean-spirited, and none of it is meant to be, like, creepy. Everyone that meets Erlynn loves Erlynn and thinks he's a sweetheart, so we were hoping that that would, you know, come across in the movie. I mean, I'm sure there are a few people who are offended, but sounds like that they have a problem if they find this offensive.
Well, I think it's a weird thing, though, because you don't hear that kind of dialogue and that age range and it not be something you're supposed to be concerned with. You know what I mean? I don't know. Right. So I think that's why it's, like, refreshing. But I think I could see how it could take a viewer a moment to be like, oh, okay, I mean, this is fine. I wasn't offended, but it's definitely,
yeah.
You know, the approach is different.
Well, it's, you know, it's all, but the thing that you realize in the movie is, like, it's all just talk, you know?
Yeah.
This is a guy that likes to present himself a certain way and it makes him feel good about himself. But, you know, all in all, it's just talk and he never acts on anything. And he's, you know, he's not a bad guy.
So. Yeah.
I have to tell you something that you might not like.
Okay, what?
I bought us 2 first-class tickets to Iceland. The hot springs, the juicy, fantastic lobsters, and the gorgeous broads.
I don't like lobster.
I'll eat your lobster.
Incredible location shooting. What was it like shooting in Iceland?
It was wonderful. I mean, being there was exciting. You know, most of our crew had never been to Iceland before. We brought, you know, most of our crew over from the States. We had some Icelandic crew members, but, you know, it was like invigorating, I guess, being there. You know, the air is so clean and wonderful, and, you know, there's a chill in the air that makes you feel really alive. So that was special. I would love to shoot there again.
Yeah.
They do things a little differently in terms of just basic production. They're a little more laid back. You know, Americans are notorious for being super high strung. And when you're making a movie, you're so high strung. So sometimes our Icelandic co-producers would be like, you all are really overreacting. It's okay. Things will get done. The location, you know, you will lock the location, don't worry, you know, and we're always like, go, go, go. And they don't answer their emails every day like we do. You know,
yeah.
we get offended if someone doesn't answer our email within, you know, 24 hours, and they go like a week without answering their email. And
between that and all the hot springs and spa, perhaps they have it figured out in a way we don't.
They, Exactly.
Were you guys able to take advantage of some of, you know, the natural, you know, the hot springs and things like that while you're shooting, or were you too busy?
We were too busy to do some of it. We did go to the abandoned geothermal pool on our day off and swam, and that was fun. And there are cool, like, communal swimming pools in Reykjavik with, like, hot pots. You can, it's kind of like a hot tub, but it's just really hot water. It's not bubbling. But it all feels really good, especially, you know, in October.
The music in the film, your use of music, particularly in montage or traveling scenes, it's either 80s music or music that's really reminiscent of 80s films. And I thought it was an interesting choice to have this beautiful, you know, natural imagery juxtaposed with bouncy, somewhat synthetic music. Was this at all a nod to some of the 80s films that they talk about?
I think, you know, once we got on, you know, set, what we realized while we were in pre-production in Iceland was that this movie was very much like, you know, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and some of the sort of 80s buddy movies. So that was, it was sort of a nod to the spirit of those movies. And, you know, the, also like, you know, Twins, which they mention in the movie. I guess people would expect us to have music from maybe their generation or, you know, basic score. But we thought it was kind of a fun change to do something a little more pop music, you know?
Yeah. They talk about movies a lot too. Is that something that has developed naturally?
Yeah. Well, when we shot the Kentucky scene, they started talking about movies randomly. And so then we decided to incorporate that a little more because it was pretty funny to hear them talk about, you know, a lot of movies that were released like 20 years ago. So it's funny because they're kind of out of touch, you know?
Yeah.
They're not really talking about contemporary film. They're bringing up Pretty Woman and Sleepless in Seattle, and I think that that's funny.
We've lost track of the hotel.
I don't know why I listen to what you say, Mitch.
This is like one of those horror movies.
For current film students or, you know, people in our listening area that might be listening who attend School of the Arts or in the film program, you know, any words of wisdom as they finish school and set out on their careers?
I mean, it's hard because it's, you know, the landscape is always changing. And, you know, when I got out of school, it's, you know, it was making independent films is much different than it is even right now because it, you know, accessibility, and it's so easy to make, not easy to make movies now, but you have, you know, things at your fingertips to make movies now. And I guess what I would just say is, like, don't get discouraged. You know, one thing I remember is getting out of school and just kind of being like, well, what do I do now as a director? Because I didn't have like a specific skill that I could go, you know, use to make a living. And I think it's just about persistence. I mean, this is cheesy, but just trying, just really continuing to try and to not let yourself, you know, quit, I guess, and make things and write things and practice. If you don't sit down and write constantly, then you're going to be rusty. So just always keep yourself well oiled in that way.
Yeah, well, that's great advice. Well, thank you very much for taking some time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
Filmmaker Martha Stevens, along with Aaron Katz, she co-wrote and co-directed the film Land Ho. Land Ho is now available on Blu-ray and on demand after successful theatrical and festival runs. Visit WFDD.org for trailers and links to the film's website. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm technical producer Eddie Garcia. We have to take a 60-second break, but when we return, it's the innovative and inviting guitar tapestries of Nashville's William Tyler when Triad Arts Weekend continues. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. Growing up in Nashville, Tennessee, William Tyler was raised by a father who wrote songs for the likes of Eddie Rabbit and a mother who called Alex Chilton of Big Star a friend. He spent his early 20s playing as a sideman with the band Lamb Chop. And along the way, he also strummed alongside Bonnie Prince Billy and Silver Jews. As a solo guitarist, William Tyler uses the instrument as a wide-angle lens. His music, to me, evokes images of America's panoramic past and the unsettling path we've taken from the 50s to the present. His guitar playing is really nimble, but not showy. His use of effects is a component of his sound, but never a crutch. He uses open tunings and fuses elements of drone, psychedelia, and straight-up pure experimentalism. But somehow, through all this, his music remains wholly accessible. When I spoke with William, he was sitting on a porch in Durham, North Carolina, a day before he took the stage at Baldwin Auditorium to kick off a series of concerts celebrating 25 years of Merge Records. What kind of music did you play as a teenager? Like, what kind of stuff were you doing?
It was very, like, 70s-influenced power pop, rock pile, Elvis Costello, The Jam, that kind of stuff. That was kind of the limit of my guitar vocabulary. It was, like, playing rhythm guitar, you know, maybe kind of like Buddy Holly style, like, sort of leads, but rhythm. So when I ended up in Lamb Chop, I actually started out on keyboard as kind of a textural keyboard player.
Now, how did you get recruited as a keyboard player?
Well, I knew Kurt, the singer, and I knew the other Lamb Chop guys. You know, they were one of those bands around town that I would try to go see them whenever they played, and I just got to be friends with those guys, and I think that Kurt probably just thought that there was sort of a novelty factor in asking somebody that was so much younger to play in the band, because everybody else in the band was like 15 years older than me.
Right.
I didn't even own a keyboard at the time, but I like went on eBay and like found a Farfisa and started practicing for a couple months and, you know, tried to learn all their songs, and then it just stuck, and then I was in the band for 12 years.
Wow. And then just during that time you kind of switched over to playing guitar with them?
Yeah, I joined when Nixon came out. Then there was kind of a big turning point after that album where I think he realized that he couldn't financially support like a 13-piece band and also have everybody have day jobs. And so when we did the next record, which was the first record I actually played on, Is a Woman, the whole sound of the band changed drastically, and it sort of got sonically reduced. They all kind of liked the way I played rhythm, and I just sort of like apprenticed or worked my way up to, by the end of the time I was in the band, I was essentially the primary guitar player. But that was, you know, that was over a course of, you know, almost 10 years.
And during that time, were you also performing as a solo artist, like trying out your own stuff in clubs, or was it just focused on Lamb Chop?
Not really. I just sort of backed away creatively from doing anything on my own. I mean, I look at like the first 4 or 5 years that I was in Lamb Chop almost kind of like a college frat experience, you know, like just going out with a bunch of older guys, getting drunk all the time and like trying to be in a band. I mean, not that we were a huge party band. I sort of feel like when I was younger, I was writing all my own songs and I was, you know, very creatively focused, and then that didn't work out. I just sort of put off thinking about doing my own music. And then at some point when I was about 25, 26, I started teaching myself how to play the fingerstyle way, which worked well within the context of playing with Lamb Chop. But I just realized, oh, yeah, this is actually like a form of music that I really feel like I could get into. I mean, it was, you know, you get into it largely because it's almost like it's a solo activity. So it's very therapeutic. It's like painting or you know, long distance running or something. I mean, it doesn't involve the input of other people. And when you're trying to find your voice creatively after a period where you've felt a little listless, doing something like that can be very empowering and meditative. And I wasn't good at it for a really long time. I remember the first couple times I did it in front of people, there was enough of a reaction to where I felt like, okay, I think this might be something I should pursue, at least just as a hobby. I didn't ever intend it to be a serious pursuit. Yeah, so there was a transition period where I was doing it. I put my first record out when I was like 28, 29. And then that was kind of, I guess, right at the end of where sort of my full-time involvement in Lamb Chop started winding down a little bit at the same time. But it was all happen in a very like natural way.
That first record, Behold the Spirit, you know, it's full of finger-picked acoustic guitar playing, but you also have some tracks like Signal Mountain or To the Finland Station, mm-hmm. you know, that are much more mm-hmm. ambient in nature with little dissonant touches and volume swells and eerie layers of static. How did those elements start finding their way into your music alongside the guitar playing?
I think from a pretty early point, I was interested in integrating noise and sound, other sound elements. I never looked at it, any of this, as being some sort of pure expression of being a solo, quote, solo guitar player. Now, I had to do that just because out of necessity, but I think, like a lot of people, I was influenced by the Jim Rohrt stuff from the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, Papa M, all the Thrill Jockey mm-hmm. stuff from Chicago. A lot of the more experimental stuff that was on labels like Silk Breeze. I think with Behold the Spirit, I mean, it is primarily an acoustic. I feel like it's sort of like the acoustic guitar is like the lead singer, but there's all these other cast members in it. And I just like, I kind of wanted to do a cycle of things that where there was like these sort of gaps of ambient space, and it gave a little of relief to the melody and the, I don't know, I mm-hmm. it just sort of worked out that way. That's always been something that's really interested me, sound collage and all that. So
well, then your next record, Impossible Truth, which was released in 2013 on Merge Records, that saw more of that stuff coming up to the forefront, and you're playing electric guitar on that one for the most part, mm-hmm. correct? And there's more layering going on, and there's a little more obvious, not over the top, but obvious treatment with effects and things like that. The results are really cinematic. Are you heavily influenced by film, and not just film scores, but by film in general?
Yeah, I'm both, actually. Mm-hmm. I was always interested in film. I mean, when I was before I got really interested in music, when I was a teenager, I was really, really interested in film. I mean, I watched hundreds of movies and read film books, and I mean, I was really interested in pursuing that somehow. But I also realized that it's really expensive to make films, even like home movies.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is probably not something I can just do myself. But yeah, I was always interested in the synthesis of film and music. And a lot of my favorite directors, like Kubrick or Herzog or whoever, have always figured out really touchstone ways of doing that. I mean, I was just use a specific example. It's one that actually comes out. I mean, Popol Vuh is like one of my biggest influences stylistically. And I wouldn't have known about his music were it not for his Herzog soundtracks. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I mean, I like it when people make those comparisons. I mean, Rykooter is a big influence. I mean, I don't necessarily imagine visuals when I'm writing those songs, mm-hmm. but like when you say the word cinematic and like trying to, I think especially with Impossible Truth, I was trying to draw on that a little more, like make it almost sound like a soundtrack to an imaginary film.
Well, when you're listening to it, or I can say as a listener, you know, if like driving in the car listening to it, it almost makes you start to feel like you're in a movie. Like you almost can see yourself driving the car. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, it's an album that's sort of about kind of the West, and not that it's a Western, but I mean, there's a lot of wide open space, and the sound's very big, and I totally understand that. I mean, I've had the same effect listening to similar style music, driving, and you know, long drives, and kind of imagining things, and that's one of the things that I like about writing instrumental music is that it's not immediate, I guess, but it does allow a lot of space for the listener to conjure up different ideas, images, and associations that would not exist there with the tyranny of lyricism and, you know, being told a story by somebody. And, you know, there's a certain comfort in that, but there's also a certain freedom in just listening to music without words and being able to make your own associations.
Guitarist William Tyler. William recently reissued his first LP, Desert Canyon, on Record Store Day. He'll also have some new material out as part of a massive box set on Three Lobed Records later this year. More on that later this summer. Visit WFDD.org for videos and links to the music of William Tyler. Well, that's all for today's program. Our executive producer is David Ford, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find archived episodes and podcasts on our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You can follow us on Twitter as well, at Triad Arts Speak. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Email your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. For 88.5 WFDD, I'm Eddie Garcia. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.